And good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. We got a nice sunny day here in Illinois, and it's actually pretty nice and warm out, just a beautiful day. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the Progressive Radio Network is definitely moving forward. We're involved with education, information, providing you resources, giving you history, providing you the information you need to make decisions about the future based on the past. Well, this is August 4th, 2013. We're going to take a trip back into the past right now. We're going to discuss some ramifications and things that happened in August of 1945. For those of you in the military, those of you who served during World War II, the Korea, Vietnam, and everything else, any time in the military at all, especially World War II, you're totally aware that in August of 1945, the United States dropped two atomic bombs, one on Hiroshima and another one on Nagasaki. And as a consequence, the war era of the atomic weapon, the nuclear weapon, was entered into. The consequences of that have been devastating, and tonight we're going to talk about this a little bit tonight. What happened? How did it get there? How did it all start? What does it mean? Where is it going? And what is it for the future? In order to do this, I've got some guests we're going to do. And Patricia, are you online?
I sure am. Hello, Doug. How are you doing tonight?
Great.
Good, good. Good to hear your voice.
And Patricia, can you, as our other guest on, can you introduce our other guest?
John, he's on?
Yeah, John Steinbach is here.
Hi, John. Well, I'm Patricia Axelrod. I conduct the Desert Storm Think Tank and all veterans advocates, and I'm going to allow John to introduce himself. John, would you be so kind as to give us just a profile of your work and who you are?
Well, I guess, first of all, I'm an old friend of yours, Patricia. I've known you for how many years? 25 years, I guess. Oh,
I guess maybe so, 25 or 30, something like that. We're giving away our age, aren't we, John?
And you are. I'm even older.
Yeah.
But I'm an activist in Washington, D.C. I've been an activist, anti-war activist, anti-intervention activist in the Washington, D.C. area, and I've done a lot of work with the atomic bomb survivors and have studied the history of the atomic bombings and the decision to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Mm-hmm. And Doug, are you there?
Yes, I am. You know, as we come onto this thing, I mean, as we've talked about on this show before, my role, and it ended up in the military that consumed a lot of my military life, was working with depleted uranium. And depleted uranium is some primary byproduct of the uranium enrichment process, where fissionable isotope, primarily U-235, 234, which are then also made to transform to come up with plutonium, are used to make reactor fuel and nuclear weapons. And in this case, nuclear weapons is the topic of the evening. And it's important to understand that the two are tied together, as Patricia knows and as John know also well, because 99% of all material that goes into the process to make nuclear weapons comes out as uranium hexafluoride, and that is the waste that's then turned into depleted uranium and created the nightmare. So we've got the atomic bomb and the development of that and everything that led into the depleted uranium munitions and everything, which is now having a horrific effect on everybody, where we don't actually have a fissionable device or a fusion device going off, but we have all the radioactive isotopes being spread all over. And as John and Patricia are totally aware of, back the S-2 committee at the time of General Groves and Robert Oppenheimer developed the nuclear weapon, they had to come up and had an idea. Well, what are we going to do with 99% of all the waste that we're developing? And that was the original order called the Groves Memorandum, to use radioactive materials as dirty bombs to end the war both in Germany and Japan. This is before the development of the atomic bomb. Well, as I look at this stuff, the other thing with the development of the atomic bomb, and I know Patricia is very familiar with this because my role is in the Army, I had the pleasure, distinct honor, and everything to know and work with Paul Tibbetts. And for history, Paul Tibbetts is the man that commanded the atomic bomb droppings of both the Enola Gay and Boxcar back in 1945. And what was really strange, and I don't know how history comes about, Patricia and John, you never know where it's going to be, right?
Mm-hmm. That's
true. In 1990, 45 years to the hour, I spent the whole weekend, basically a week with Paul Tibbetts, and we discussed all of this stuff, the ramifications of what had happened with Hiroshima and Nagasaki, as we were building up for Operation, what became Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm, in other words, war in the Middle East that is still raging and created a nightmare. And one of the strange things about all this stuff is Paul gave me, and I've got it right in front of me, he gave me his memoirs called The Flight of the Enola Gay by Paul W. Tibbetts, and he gave me a videotape, and this was signed by, again, him and his crew, 45 years almost to the hour of the original drop. And so I had the opportunity to meet with Theodore J. Van Kirk, the navigator, Paul Tibbetts, a pilot, and more important, Thomas Farabee, the bombardier who actually dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima that day. Mm-hmm. So, again, for me, all this stuff comes and ties together because, and then having worked with the Japanese so much and worked, again, up in an area that no longer exists as a result of Fukushima, for me, all this stuff is tied together and has horrific events. So I guess why don't we open up and talk about a little about how did we get to this point?
Doug, yeah. I'm here too.
Denise? I beg your pardon?
Patricia, are you okay? Hey, Denise, you're here too.
Yeah, and I called in because I wanted to listen in and be part of the discussion because some of my early work before I met you, and I met Pat at my first trip to D.C., but met up with Coy Overstreet, Bikini Island atomic vet with the atomic testing, and learned from him and went with him down to New Mexico to the Experimental Radiation Presidential Advisory Committee. So that goes back many years, and
well,
Coy has since died.
Let me make a suggestion, if I might, for the benefit of those folks who aren't as old as us but are younger and don't quite understand the significance of this. Perhaps we should begin with the bomb on Hiroshima, which was dropped at 2:45 a.m. on a Monday on August 6th. And it was the equivalent of 20,000 tons, and it was called Little Boy, and approximately 70,000 people died immediately. And then thereafter, on August 9th at 11:02, a bomb was dropped on Nagasaki, and it killed also approximately 70,000 people. And there's a great debate that rages about this, and perhaps we'll discuss this briefly and then dispose of it. And that debate is that this was necessary to end the war. So I'll throw the gauntlet down, and let's hear something on this, shall we?
Okay. So who wants to talk first?
You go first, John.
Okay. Well, the myth, I would call it the myth, that the bomb was dropped to end the war and saved millions of American lives came from Harry Truman in the aftermath of the atomic bombing. There was some controversy over the decision to drop the bomb. And interestingly enough, I know that there are a number of military folks there. I think it's not well understood by a lot of military, and I'm a veteran myself of the Coast Guard. It's not well understood that virtually the entire military leadership at that time opposed the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki when they learned about it. So William Leahy was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. His position was, the quote, I'm paraphrasing it a little bit, but his quote was, I wasn't taught to wage war against women and children. He was very, very vociferous in opposing the dropping of the bomb. Eisenhower, when he was told about it, said Japan was already defeated. Quote, it wasn't necessary to hit them with this barbaric thing. So those two used ethical and moral arguments against dropping the bomb. But it was people like Curtis LeMay and Douglas MacArthur who also opposed the dropping of the bomb, but they opposed it on very practical grounds, and that was it absolutely wasn't necessary. Both LeMay and MacArthur said Japan was already defeated. They were on the verge of surrender. It was militarily unnecessary to drop the bomb. And in fact, the Joint Chiefs of Staff commissioned a study on the dropping of the bomb, which was published in the fall of 1945 after the bomb was dropped. And the Joint Chiefs of Staff determined that the bomb had very little impact on actually ending the war. They argued that it was the entry of the Soviet Union into the war on August the 8th, which was the major precipitating factor in the Japanese decision to drop the bomb. But they went further than that, and they said that Japan, that no invasion was necessary, that Japan would have surrendered by November 1st if the bombs had not been dropped and if the Soviets had not entered the war. So there was a lot of opposition from the military. The other interesting area where opposition came from was from the Republican Party of all places. So it was people like Joseph Drew, who was a former diplomat, and former President Herbert Hoover, who, after he became president, became ambassador to Japan. And they were arguing, the Republicans were, and Howard Taft also was part of this camp, making the same argument. They wanted to end the war, and Hoover and the others believed that the war could be negotiated, an end of the war could be negotiated quickly, providing the emperor was permitted to keep his throne. And in fact, Hoover offered to personally go to Japan and negotiate a surrender. So the irony is if, in fact, that avenue had been pursued, the war could have ended in the spring of 1945. Many of the major atrocities that happened, the major battles in the Pacific, could have been avoided, and literally millions of lives could have been spared had there been a negotiation in the spring of 45 that we ended up negotiating anyway in late August of 1945.
Yeah, one of the things that I'd like to enter in this, as John has just done this, I'm going to actually read from the actual official report. This is Manhattan, the Army and the Atomic Bomb, written by Vincent C. Jones, Center for Military History of the United States Army. And when we look at the criteria, and I'm going to just read this verbatim, the easiest way to understand this. The committee met first on May 10th in Los Alamos, and then the third meeting was on May 28th in Washington, D.C., and again, this is a committee to determine whether the bomb should be dropped and all of this stuff. Quote, the committee carefully considered various criteria, the maximum range for the loaded B-29 aircraft, the need for a visual bombing, likely weather conditions, and expected damage. Last criteria weighed heavily on the committee, for it pointed up the necessity to select targets where the bomb would produce the maximum damage and hence have the profoundest impact upon enemy morale. Project scientists had indicated the bomb would most likely achieve the desired results if it were dropped in a densely built-up areas of significant value to the Japanese war effort. They also had emphasized the target should not have been bombed previously so the effects might be assessed more accurately. And so we come on and we continue, and what they had picked up on, these were the targets of choice. First off was Kokura Arsenal. The next one, again, that's Hiroshima is the next one.
And Kokura was discounted because of the weather over there. Is that correct?
Correct, yeah. And that was the second one. Then Nagata, mm-hmm. and then Kyoto. So those are the four original targets that were picked up for the actual attacks that were going to be done on those days. And mm-hmm. again, what happened, obviously, is when they went in for the first bombing, Kyoto was clouded over, so they went out of Hiroshima. And then they went back again the second time for Kokura, and again it was clouded over, and that's how they ended up with Nagasaki. So again, mm-hmm. this was the rationale. So when we look at the thing and they have the discussion, and John, you were very clear on this, and thank you very much, about saving lives. But as you mentioned, if you read The Longest Day and all the other reports, are very clear on what had happened. They were ready to negotiate and to end the war because of the devastating effects. But again, we have to come back when we look at the reports, and as I've studied this and talked to the various individuals involved, I mean, talk to the individuals that pushed the button who are at peace with themselves for very good reasons and everything about what had happened. But it was very, very clear that the dropping of the atomic bombs was done in absolute total retaliation for Pearl Harbor, and again for the criteria that I just read directly out of the report. And so,
Doug, if I can say something, it's important to remember that Tibbetts and the people that dropped the bomb, they really had no understanding of the big picture whatsoever, and that was true of almost everybody. Eisenhower didn't know until almost the last minute. Leahy, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was not in the loop. This was a very tightly guarded secret. One of the things that happened, of course, scientists that were working on it, on the bomb, knew about it. And it was the scientists originally. It was Leo Szilard and Teller and Albert Einstein that went to Roosevelt and said, we believe there's a possibility of building an atomic bomb. We believe that Hitler might get it. And that was the beginning of the Manhattan Project. But when those scientists, especially Szilard, understood that the Nazis weren't going to get the bomb, there was a concerted effort on the part of the scientists to stop the bombing. So there were petitions that were filed. Szilard wrote a letter to Truman. There was an effort made to personally meet with Truman. So they did. Many of the scientists, not all of them, but many of them, did everything in their power to prevent the bombing. But there were scientists like Oppenheimer, for example, and Teller. And Oppenheimer was part of the interim committee, and you were reading some of the report. But I wanted to add one other direct quote from the minutes of the interim committee when they were deciding on a target. They said, no warning should be given. And this is the direct quote. They said, we should select, quote, a vital war plant employing a large number of workers and closely surrounded by workers' houses, unquote. So this was calculated as a horrific experiment on closely clustered workers' housing, wooden housing, to see what, to maximize the impact of the bomb, to see what the impact was, with no regard for the fact that overwhelmingly the victims of the bomb were women, children, the elderly, and the Korean War slaves that had been moved to Hiroshima and to Nagasaki to work in the arms factories there.
And then they also find out until later that there were U.S. military prisoners of war also housed there.
I would also
interject. About 2,000 were killed. I'm sorry, Patricia.
Right.
About 2,000 POWs. Go ahead.
Right. I would also interject that while this may well have been in retaliation for Pearl Harbor, if we will explore the times and look at what was happening at that point, recall that Germany was engaged in the development of a bomb. And I have been led to believe that perhaps one of the foremost reasons for dropping the bomb was, as the target committee said, that they wanted the first bomb to be sufficiently spectacular, this is an exact quote, for the importance of the weapon to be internationally recognized when publicity on it was released, thereby gaining world dominance and superiority in the wake of a world war where we had been engaged with Russia. And Russia, by this time, we were already beginning to eye them suspiciously. So I would say to you that not only was there perhaps that reason to strike back, but also to establish world dominance in the wake of this war.
I agree with you, Patricia. P.M.S. Blackett was a British physicist. He was peripherally involved in the Manhattan Project. He was a Nobel Prize winner. And he argued that the atomic bombings, quote, were not so much the last military act of the Second World War as the first major operation of the Cold War with Russia, unquote. So a lot of people, a lot of analysts agree with your position.
And let's also bear in mind that each of the bombs, the one over Hiroshima and the one over Nagasaki, were different. The Nagasaki was plutonium, 239, and the Hiroshima was uranium. So not only were they engaged in retaliating, but they were also experimenting.
That's very, very true. When we look at the Hiroshima bomb, again, was uranium, and that was a gun-type bomb versus Nagasaki, which is an implosion-type bomb. So totally different types of design on everything. They were used for both of those with, I mean, substantially different 12 versus 20 kiloton weapons. And, I mean, 12 and 20 kiloton, that's very, very, very small in comparison to today's megatons.
Absolutely. So with that said, I wonder if we can all agree that while the persons who dropped the bomb were not wholly aware of the consequences thereof, surely they weren't cognizant of the fact that they were letting the genie out of the bottle, which is casting a shadow over our modern society. But that, in fact, what we did as a country in that time was to establish dominance, and to we had living laboratories there, and that is supported by the fact that, as you each know, for some 10 years following the bombing of each of these cities, the United States and England sent in scientists and doctors who studied the Hubakusan, the survivors of these bombings, as though they were lab animals.
You know, and that has resulted in the book called The Effects of Nuclear Weapons. Again, it's the primary book that those of us in the field within the military use. Again, you can go to your library. It should be in a lot of libraries, The Effects of Nuclear Weapons. Headquarters of the Department of the Army, and this is a Department of the Army pamphlet, 50-3, which discusses all of this in depth, but it also provides the direct information, again, based on the testing, based on the drop of the atomic bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, based on the Bikini Atoll and all the other stuff, much less the tests in Nevada and down in Mexico. What are the true effects, and what is going to happen, and what could be the future, and how could all this be designed? And when we look at this stuff, and then involved in planning, I was back in the 60s and 69, I was 69-70, I was actually on alert duty on B-52s as an alert crew member for maintenance and everything, where we were sitting there right on the end of the runway maintaining the aircraft that were fully loaded with nuclear weapons, ready to go to war.
Mm-hmm. And such was the case in the Gulf War and every other actual war that the United States has been engaged in since that time. We are actively engaged in deploying nuclear weapons, and I don't believe that the average American understands that, that this is part of our war plan, that we are the only country that's actually dropped these bombs in anger on a civilization, on a people, and we have a first strike policy still to this day, and each and every time we prepare to go to war, we go to war with our nuclear weapons.
I think another thing's important to understand, and I was involved in this frightening cell because, again, I was maintaining B-52 aircraft, and Richard Nixon actually made the decision that we should use a nuclear bomb in Vietnam. And again, this was reported about 10 or 11 years ago, when the large batch against the tapes from the National Archives, the Nixon tapes and everything, came on out and totally confirmed the fact that Nixon did advocate using the atomic bomb. Quote, "I'd rather use a nuclear bomb," Nixon told Kissinger, his national security advisor, a few weeks before he ordered a major escalation of the Vietnam War. And then, quote, that I think would be just too much," Kissinger replied softly in his baritone voice in a conversation uncovered among 500 hours of Nixon tapes released, okay, at this time. So again, Kissinger stopped Nixon, Tricky Dick, from dropping the atomic bombs. And that wasn't the first time, because we had done it in 69 and again all the way through. So here's the report that came out confirming it.
Doug, I'd like to go back to talk about the study of the Hiroshima as guinea pigs. But I just wanted to point out that in his book, in his memoirs, Nixon's book, he gave credit to the May 15th mass mobilization that brought 500,000 people, I believe it was 1969, to Washington, D.C. And he said that it was the mass of people in the streets that prevented him from carrying out his nuclear threat. So he had a slightly different take on it. I suspect probably Kissinger is more credible on this, but Nixon gave credit to the mass organizing that took place.
Well, in 1969, I was with the B-52s loaded with bombs on the end of the runway when it did get stopped. So, yeah, it had a direct effect, and the missions did not get launched, even though the aircraft were loaded.
Yeah, by the way, I would like to, for the record, there's a lot of talk. There was some stuff on the news yesterday about Vietnam veterans finally being able to come home and not being spit upon and so on. But I would like to point out that if you look at the real leadership of the anti-war movement during the Vietnam War, the real leadership was led by GIs that came back from Vietnam. So, I want to be really, really clear on this. And personally, I can tell you, in the Coast Guard, my 2 years that I spent in Hawaii and Yokosuka, Japan, in the Coast Guard, those were my teachers were the GIs that were coming back from Vietnam who were educating me about how crazy and how absurd this war was. So I think people need to remember that the role that the veterans played in stopping the Vietnam War, and I think also the Iraq War as well, and probably all wars, really.
Why don't we talk about the effects on the Japanese and also the effects on the Americans that were involved in all the nuclear testing and everything. So, John, why don't you talk a little, start about the Japanese, and then, Denise, you can come in with the individuals, what happened on the testing.
Let me do this. Is this Denise Nelson? This is not Denise Nelson, right?
No.
Although okay. I know her.
All right. So let me just start, Denise, and then I'm going to turn it over to you. So
if I might give you a firsthand view from a survivor, if I could start this off, and then you take it from there. Here's a survivor of Hiroshima saying, or Nagasaki saying, the pumpkin field in front of the house was blown clean. Nothing was left of the whole thick crop except that in place of the pumpkins, there was a woman's head. I looked at the face to see if I knew her. It was a woman of about 40. She must have been from another part of town. I had never seen her around here. A gold tooth gleamed in the wide open mouth. A handful of singed hair hung down from the left temple over her cheek, dangling in her mouth. Her eyelids were drawn up, showing black holes where the eyes had been burned out. She had probably looked square into the flash and gotten her eyeballs burned. 70,000 died immediately, and 70,000 died within another 5 years. So please take it from there.
Okay, so we know that the decision to drop the bomb was an experiment. They were looking for a city that hadn't been bombed, that was concentrated with workers' houses, wooden houses, unsupported houses. After the bomb was dropped, an organization was set up called the Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission that later became the Radiation Effects Research Center. And the ABCC had the most up-to-date medical facilities in Hiroshima and in Nagasaki, with all of the most modern equipment and all of the most experienced doctors. But they would literally go to the schools, and they would take the school children away from school, and they would study them. And in fact, the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki were the most studied survivors up until the Marshall Islanders came in the picture, and Denise is going to talk about that in a second. But one of the terms of the study was that the survivors would be brought into the hospital. They would be examined, but there was a very strict and deliberate policy that the doctors that were examining the patients could not treat them. It was called the no treatment policy. This was a U.S. government occupation policy, and the rationale was that if they treated the patients, that somehow this would be an acknowledgement of guilt for having dropped the bomb. So it was very controversial. I've spoken to many dozens of survivors, and to a woman and man, they are very deeply resentful of the way they were treated as guinea pigs, and especially this no pussy.
Not only were they observed, but they were filmed, and there were thousands and thousands of feet of film that remained classified until the late 80s, and then that film became declassified, and the Japanese people bought that film back from the United States government at 10 foot at a time, and that was called the 10 Feet Committee, and a film was made of it called The Prophecy, which was released at the United Nations, and that made an enormous difference in educating people about the consequences and effects of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
And the film footage was Technicolor film footage. The U.S. government literally confiscated all color film stock in the entire world in order to document the horrors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And the person in charge of that was Herbert Sassan. And he later became very remorseful, and he spent a great deal of the latter part of his life looking for that footage because he felt that humanity had to see the footage. In the end, it turned out that he was lied to about where it was, and it was a Japanese researcher that found it, and it was essentially in a storeroom in the bottom of the National Archives here in Washington, D.C. And
right.
the other thing, Patricia, is that the 10-foot campaign was, to a great extent, the money was raised by school children. I don't know if you know that or not, but
yes.
It was raised, and Prophecy is the film most people have seen, but there was a shorter version called Lost Generation, and then there was an hour-and-a-half feature-length film called Dynasty. And that I actually have in the basement of my house, and I have the translated script. So at some point we'll have a world premiere of the English language version of the longer feature length film.
Mm-hmm. So Denise, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, and y'all are going to have to help out because. Basically, I met Coy Overstreet as he was speaking out for the Gulf War veterans right after the war. He and Vic Sylvester, both Vietnam vets, and Coy had been in Vietnam. He had also been part of the atomic testing, Bikini Islands and various ones. He had also served on the Marine Corps Squadron 1 in NASA and also went to Russia on the Test Ban Treaty. So he was a very, very interesting guy as I got to know him. And basically, you know, they did get presumptions on the atomic veterans, as they're called, and they list every cancer in the book now. The only thing that I think that he wanted to do things different from the atomic vets and Agent Orange veterans was to get in there early with Gulf War veterans. Now, his daughter was a nurse that served with us over in the Gulf War. And in finding out more about Coy, he had also been in Naval Intel. Very interesting guy, and I learned a lot about DU. He was part of the beginning of looking at the DU problem. I don't have the report in front of me, but a group of people worked on this, and it was out in the 92 time period, 91, 92.
I reviewed that study. I remember that very clearly. It was by a group out of Boston.
Right, and it was Rural Urban Something. If you remember the title, Pat, please tell me, but can't remember the title, but he taught me a lot about depleted uranium and what had happened with the atomic vets. And he said, you know, you're going to have to push hard on the Hill because you're going to need the presumptions, you know, ahead of time. not waiting until they all die. And that's exactly where we're at right now, as we have Gulf War vets dying from depleted uranium and the chemical exposures and the vaccine. You know, you've got a snowball effect of exposures from the depleted uranium used in Iraq. So,
well, for the benefit of those who aren't clearly aware of what went on here, Denise, maybe what we should do is set this up for people who aren't aware that America used American soldiers to experiment on. They, too, were guinea pigs. In the aftermath of the war and in the aftermath of the 10 years following Nagasaki and Hiroshima, scientists wanted to know more. And so what they did was deploy our own soldiers out into trenches, aboard boats in the Pacific and in other places, and bombed them, essentially,
right,
so that they could, in fact, so that American scientists could, in fact, monitor the effects and consequences. Unfortunately, they didn't choose to monitor the long-term consequences. They only monitored the immediate effects.
And I remember Foy telling me that there was no way to decontaminate the ships.
Right, and
that,
yes,
very thoroughly, is that, you know, he had the knowledge factor, and he said, Denise, you know, the cleanup after the Gulf War, there is no way that we knew to decontaminate ships, and a lot of the ships, you know, were radioactive.
Yes, and they knew that, and they understood that. It's important for the listeners to know that we're talking about the upper hundreds of thousands of GIs, and I would guess probably in the millions of GIs were exposed to these bomb tests. 500,000 were exposed to the atmospheric tests in the Nevada desert.
Right.
And then many thousands and tens of thousands more were exposed in the Marshall Islands on the ships.
And to tell you how bad it was, is there was a write-up in the VFW magazine, and this was sometime 93, 94, about the atomic vets. And their numbers at that time, that as far as claims, compensation, it was ridiculously low. It was like 6,000 at the most that had applied for compensation and benefits. And I remember, you know, Coy telling me that they really just kind of monitored them, was not proactive on watching for cancers or anything like that. So it's another black mark on America, as far as I'm concerned, that they knew what was happening and yet did not do proactive work at that time on cancer screening in any form or manner. It was like,
well, but even worse than that, Denise, we have to understand that the federal government did everything in their power not to recognize and not to compensate the radiated veterans, the downwinders, the plant victims. And this has continued to this day. And even when you can prove or you have a legitimate claim, the compensation very seldom comes even close to the actual medical costs of dealing with these cancers and so on. So the cover-up has been continuous since 1945, and it continues to this day. Look at Fukushima. Look what's happening there. Look at the deteriorating situation spiraling out of control in the lying that's going on, in the deliberate obfuscation by the press to try to keep the information about what's happening away from the people.
I know his case as an atomic vet was still, when he got sick the first time and was in the hospital when he had the cancer when it first started, was interesting, because I drove all the way over there to be with him and help his wife, who was very young and new in the marriage, to stand up, you know, to the doctors and follow through with what Coy's wishes had been. But I was standing there with the doctor, and it came out in his room before they transferred him to ICU that the records were still at the Justice Department. not within the VA. They were tied up at the Justice Department and probably still are.
Mm-hmm. And I might add that this is in the wake of legislation that was supposed to have changed all of that, that was supposed to have made it easier for atomic veterans to make a claim and to be properly compensated. So unfortunately, what we can see happening here is that the powers that be were successful in covering this up, in deceiving the public, and in manipulating the press and the public at large into believing that this was acceptable. And with this said, we continue to manufacture, research and develop nuclear weapons to this day, as well as weapons designed from tritium and other radioactive materials.
And much less talking about, you know, when I went to New Mexico with him, to Albuquerque, it was, or Santa Fe, I guess it was interesting to meet those that had been experimental victims here in the States to radiation testing, and their efforts to try to get some help. And that was a presidential advisory committee meeting that I went to with him. And beforehand, I met a lot of the atomic vets and the ones that had gone through radiation experimentation,
yes.
Civilians. So, yes, it continues. It has never stopped.
Yes, and I've talked to many downwinders and GIs, the atomic veterans, and victims of the radiation experiments, and many of them feel that that radiation, that task force that was developed under Clinton and Hazel O'Leary, that this was a big, huge cover-up in itself, and that it was a big, big sellout. And that
it was
the dog and pony show. Were never taken care of. So I will tell you that a lot of the radiation survivors are still very resentful of that, as Patricia said, dog and pony show.
And I know that came out before we had our presidential advisory committee on Gulf War. Another of the Clintons' dealings was to set up a presidential advisory committee on Gulf War illness and to deal with all that. That got extended another 18 months, I think, after their deadline was, because of a group of vets that were dissenting votes on that committee trying to stand up to people like Joyce Laskoff. So their resentment is matched by the newer groups that, you know, come back and are exposed. So our country has not learned to really take care of victims, whether they're servicemen or whether they're civilians.
No, but let's talk about what's going on right now with nuclear weapons and how many countries have nuclear weapons and where we stand today. And we all know that Mr. Obama promised that there would be changes, and he spoke of a nuclear-free world. And in fact, he was given a Nobel Peace Prize, but it is my understanding that the budget for this year, the nuclear weapons budget for this year, has more money in it for research and development and less money in it for non-proliferation than ever before. And that with every year that Obama has been in office, we are spending more and more on nuclear weapons development, and that thus far we have had 27 subcritical, so-called subcritical blasts at the Nevada test site. So we're actively engaged in testing and developing nuclear weapons and new fissile-based nuclear weapons. What do you say about all this, John?
Well, it's worse. It's actually worse than that, Patricia, because we're right now in the process of rebuilding the entire nuclear weapons production complex.
Mm-hmm.
We're spending more in real dollars right now than we were back in the 1960s and 70s to rebuild this. And the plan is that we are going to maintain the nuclear arsenal and the nuclear strategy for the next 40 to 50 years. And the other thing that's happening right now is that there is a geopolitical change. So the Cold War is over, but we're in the process, the government is in the process of restarting a Cold War. So what's happening is we're deploying anti-missiles, anti-ballistic missiles in Poland, for example, in Turkey, in Taiwan, in Okinawa, and where we are encircling and surrounding Russia and China. And so the problem is that and the purpose of these, of course, is to shoot down ballistic missiles. And the suspicions of the Russian generals and especially the Chinese generals is that, you know, this would be to shoot down missiles after we launch a first strike and take out most of their nuclear weapons. And that's basically the logic of nuclear weapons, is you have to use them or you have to lose them. And one of the big things that happened, it happened during this Bush Jr. administration, was we threw in the trash can the anti-ballistic missile treaty agreement. That was negotiated by Kissinger and Nixon, because they understood that if you had these ballistic missiles, you were going to lower the threshold to an actual nuclear war. So we have this situation with all of these anti-ballistic missiles targeting Russia and China, and at the same time, we're seeing more and more regional energy wars that are breaking out. So the question is, and everything is on launch on warning. So if the computers decide that there's an attack, everything is going to happen automatically, and the world is going to end, perhaps by a mistake, perhaps because of a computer glitch, or somebody miscalculates about what's going to happen if country A does this. And so in the meantime, you have most of the bombs that are held by the United States and Russia, but then you also have perhaps 400, 200, 400, 500 bombs held by Israel. You have over 100 held by India. You have probably about 100 by Pakistan. And then the British have their own force and the French have their force. China has about 20, 25 ICBMs that are capable of reaching the U.S. So that China is probably as close to a rational player out there as there is. The fate of the world still hangs by a thread, and we need to understand this, that the nuclear nightmare is not over. The nuclear nightmare is alive and well, and the world is hanging by a thread.
Well, I will tell you that we are planning for 2014, our request for nuclear weapons production is $7.87 billion. Imagine what we could do with that money in the name of peace and fulfillment of our society.
And then,
are you there, folks?
You know, we've got all the other changes, too, that are happening. I mean, historically, the main weapons labs are under the control of the University of California, which is now shifting back around again. So we got Livermore and Los Alamos, and then we obviously have the nuclear weapons lab right here in Illinois, and everything at Fermi, and they've got everything else. So all this stuff continues. So the labs are actually increasing in capability, but they're not only just working with nuclear weapons. They're working with nuclear, chemical, biological, the whole gambit of everything, and I find that frightening.
Oh, I do too. And what we're looking at, as an aside, if we want to think in terms of round numbers, the Obama administration has requested and is calling for a 23% increase in the budget for U.S. nuclear weapons research, manufacturing, and development over the next 5 years. It's 23%. And this is the same man who was awarded a Nobel Peace Prize. It's astounding to me. Absolutely astounding.
Can we, as we look at this stuff, obviously we have stuff up on the website. I'll send in. We can get posted the Groves memo set, which in the Groves Medical Center, all the documents, unclassified documents, going back to the Groves Project, confirms all the health effects of deliberate use and all this stuff. We got all the other reports, but are there other resources that we can direct our listeners to gather information? I mean, obviously, we got the main books, The Secret History of the Atomic Bomb. We got The Effects of Nuclear Weapons. We got the U.S. Army in World War II report, Special Studies, Manhattan, the Army, and the Atomic Bomb by the Center of Military History. What other, and then we got The Flight of Enola Gay by Paul Tibbetts. What other books and resources are out there for people to gather information?
Well, Plowshares has a lot of good information about nuclear weapons, so I can certainly recommend Plowshares. And anyone who is interested about our president's position on nuclear weapons can read a rather interesting article about how Obama learned to love the bomb, which appeared in Mother Jones. So I really want to recommend that. That's a very telling article about the transition that the alleged transition that Mr. Obama went through from speaking of a nuclear-free world into loving the bomb. I think that's an excellent article. And then again, there's the Plowshares Fund. And anyone who takes a look at that could see what nuclear weapons cost us. And the Plowshares Fund estimates that the total cost to the American taxpayer over the next decade of nuclear weapons development, which would include not only the production, operation, maintenance, cleanup, and defense of nuclear weapons, but that the total cost of that would be $640 billion over the next decade. So even that which is reported is not reported in its entirety as we look at the U.S. budget. We've got to look at the overall costs. Everyone there?
Yes, go ahead.
So I would really recommend that one takes a look at that. And then for a rather interesting look at the other side, so to speak, I would recommend that you look at the Heritage Foundation and see something called the Backgrounder. It's always interesting to know what the other side is saying. And there are forces afoot that are lobbying for more and more money to be spent on nuclear weapons. And first and foremost, and right at the forefront of that, is the Heritage Foundation. So I really want to recommend that you look at that and look at that juxtaposition to the Plowshares Fund.
And I have a suggestion for those that want to explore further, and that is the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation has a site called nuclearfiles.org. And if you go there, they have published my 12,000-word, 200-plus footnote, peer-reviewed article on the Israeli nuclear weapons program. And there are other papers of that nature. So that's a good place to go. There are also groups like Federation of American Scientists and Union of Concerned Scientists. There are lots of places to go on the internet to learn about these subjects and understand that the nuclear menace is continuing, and in some ways the danger is even perhaps increasing, because we're starting to see more and more and more of these regional conflicts, and at some point one of these regional conflicts is going to explode and perhaps result in the first use of nuclear weapons since 1945.
Yeah, I could also go back. We did a previous Warrior Connection archives, and all of us were involved in it, where we talked about the weapons in the Middle East. So our listeners can go back to the archives for Warrior Connection on that. Denise, what do you see as the medical implications and the possibility of actually getting prompt and optimal medical care for all of the nuclear casualties, especially through the VA?
Oh, good question. You know, I think about the VA, and I think about the specialty centers, and I don't see any specialty center at all within the VA on cancers or radiation effects. I really think that is missing with the VA. They ignore it. And so I guess we haven't done our job, Doug, of looking forward and pushing for the VA to do more, because we have specialty centers for multiple sclerosis, the various spinal cord injuries, and we don't have anything for the radiation victims. And you know, I think about the Navy that was over there so heavily when the tsunami hit Japan, and the Navy exposure and the effects they've had on that small number of Navy that still haven't gotten the care they need or the coverage and any presumptions of illnesses for them.
Well, we're running out of time, ladies and gentlemen. Again, thank you, everybody. Thank you for an interesting discussion. The resources out there, ladies and gentlemen. We have to take action. We have to prevent, make peace. We have to take care of our veterans. Thank you, and good night.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, everyone.
See you.